Women have been playing football for more than 150 years, and it's always been political. Some have been celebrated, but others have been ridiculed, criticized, and forgotten. This is the Forgotten 11, the hidden history of women's football.
I'm not going to the White House. No.
You know, there was a lot of critics talking about us about way back, so I suck on that one.
Give me the effing ball.
Playing like a girl means you're a badass.
Welcome to the Forgotten 11. My name is Chris McGlynn. Today, we're going to Australia to see the birth of the Matildas, Australia's national team. The Australian women's national team is called the Matildas. And before we get too deep into the team, why are they called the Matildas? Well, until the 1970s, Australia used God Save the Queen as its national anthem, and it is, like Canada and many other places, still part of the British Commonwealth. But they wanted something unique to Australia for their anthem. By the mid-1970s, Australia held a vote to determine what the new national anthem would be. The potential songs were Advance Australia Fair, Song of Australia, and Waltzing Matilda. Advance of Australia Fair won, but Waltzing Matilda was favored by nearly a third of the country. Waltzing Matilda is something like their second national anthem. It would have been a bit odd as a national anthem. It's full of uniquely Australian words, but it's also an odd story for a national anthem. It's about a hobo or a wanderer. He makes camp at a watering hole in the outback to make some tea, and he grabs whatever he can find to live on. And he puts it in his bag. Whenever he gets something good, he says to it, "You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me." A sheep comes up to get a drink from the watering hole, and he grabs the sheep and puts it in his pack. Soon the sheep's owner shows up with the police to arrest him, and in the struggle, they kill him. His ghost continues to haunt the watering hole. The song was first published in 1903, just a few years before the Australian women started playing football.
Once was a jolly swagman camped by a billabong under the shade of a coolabah tree, and he sang as he watched and waited till his billy boy, "You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me." Down came a chumbuck to drink at the billabong, up got the swaggy and grabbed him with glee, and he sang as he stowed that jumbuck in his tucker bag, "You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me." Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. And he sang as he stowed that jumbuck in his tucker bag, "You'll come a waltzing Matilda."
So, Boxing Day is the day after Christmas. It probably started in Britain, and there are various ideas on why exactly it's called Boxing Day, but it's not the sport of boxing. It probably refers to a Christmas box. It's a day off for the servants and many trades. The servants might go home to see their family with a box of leftovers and gifts from their employer. It's also a day you might tip your mail carrier, your grocer. Many churches and other organizations would have a box for you to leave a donation of food or toys or whatever for the poor. Many businesses are closed for the day, and before TV and radio and obviously podcasts, there wasn't a lot for people to do. So someone at some point decided it would be a good day for a match. In Britain and many other places, it's a huge day for whatever the local sport is. So Boxing Day, 1920. St. Helens ladies faced the Dick Kerr ladies at Goodison Park in Liverpool. 65,000 fans show up to watch two of the best women's teams in the world. Only 53,000 fit inside the stadium. The Dick Kerr ladies win the match 4-0. It was one of the biggest crowds to watch a sporting event anywhere. To put this into perspective, the average baseball game in the United States has 28,000 spectators. Basketball is about 18,000. Only the NFL regularly comes close, and only barely. Over the next few days, newspapers from New York to Sydney, Australia, report on the record-breaking match, pointing out that women in England have been playing soccer for years in front of large, enthusiastic crowds. 3 weeks after the St. Helens match, the Decatur ladies sell out Old Trafford in Manchester and play in front of 35,000 fans. In New South Wales, Australia, a newspaper reports that there are more than 60 women's teams in England, and some even own their own football grounds. Well, that wasn't true, but they didn't know it. Australian women apparently heard that news and said, "No kidding. I think we'll give that a try." So June and July of 1921 were busy for these Australian women. In 1921, there were at least three women's teams in Brisbane. Throughout the east coast of Australia, there were at least a dozen teams playing private matches and training. In Toowoomba, just outside Brisbane, there were five teams in 1921. In Sydney, four teams formed by July. In Brisbane itself, more than 100 women expressed interest in forming teams, and on July 8th, the women in Brisbane form the Queensland Ladies Soccer Football Association. These women had also heard that there was already a women's football association in Newcastle, about 100 miles north of Sydney. La Trobe Ladies FC was the first Brisbane side, and it was quickly followed by South Brisbane FC and Brisbane Ladies FC. And a little fun fact for you here about the word soccer. Notice the Australian Women's Association is called the Queensland Ladies Soccer Football Association. Now, this is partly to distinguish it from all the other forms of football, like Aussie rules and rugby. But the word soccer comes from the abbreviation of the word association, A-S-S-O-C. So S-O-C turns into soccer. Anyway, the first meeting of the Queensland Ladies Soccer FA was concerned with determining appropriate uniforms, pursuing an affiliation with the Men's Football Association, the Queensland FA, and arranging matches with the women's teams in nearby Toowoomba. The Queensland FA refused to consider their requests. Queensland FA were against women even playing a match, and they worked to deny them grounds. So the women in Queensland decided to more or less ignore the men's federation, and a woman named Jean McGregor Lowndes first negotiated to play a match before a men's Aussie rules football match. The Australian Football League would also pay the women to play, the equivalent of a few thousand dollars for the match. Aussie rules football is something like rugby, and something like American football, and something all its own. Aussie rules football is also the oldest variation of football in the world. Its rules were formalized in 1859, 4 years before the association in England, and almost 15 years before rugby. In Queensland in 1921, Aussie rules football was losing fans to rugby. They figured they could hold a doubleheader with a women's soccer match and boost their own sport. When the Queensland FA found out about this arrangement, they quickly changed their minds and decided to affiliate with the Queensland Ladies Soccer Football Association and let the women play at least recreational matches. The chairman of the Queensland FA, John William Kendall, resigned in protest of the women playing. The Australian press was somewhat surprisingly sympathetic to the women. One article in Brisbane's Telegraph describes the Queensland FA as being childish. Quote, "I cannot for the life of me see the need for opposition to the ladies' affiliation. It really does seem a pity that such a trivial thing should have been the cause of the delegates of the QFA squabbling amongst themselves like a lot of school children." On September 24th, 1921, two women's teams, North and South Brisbane, play the first public women's match in Australia in front of 10,000 fans just outside Brisbane, Australia. The stadium, nicknamed the Gabba, hosted 5% of the entire population of Brisbane. The match was also a commercial success, pulling in the equivalent of about $5,000 US. Modern money. The match was played as the second of three matches that day at the GABA. The first was a second-tier men's match, followed by the women, and lastly, a men's match between expats from the UK and local men from Queensland. The press was most interested in the women's match. They seemed impressed with the women's ability. North Brisbane won 2-0. A few weeks later, women's teams play another match in front of 3,000 fans. So it wasn't just the men pulling in an audience for the women. But as always, the misogyny starts early. Many in the press argue that association football is a man's game, that it's too dangerous for women, and that it's undignified. And it's not just association football. Australian women are now playing rugby in front of large crowds. At least one women's rugby match saw an attendance of 30,000 in Sydney. In December, Australia hears word that the English FA has banned women's football on all English FA grounds. And the various Australian football associations, soccer, rugby, Aussie rules football, follow suit and also ban the women. In 1922, the women in Queensland decide to continue playing, but with a bit of a change. To avoid public criticism and get a handle on the publicity, they will play their matches privately, with select members of the press invited to report only after the matches have been played. The player shyness of the press and the public means that the matches in 1922 are not well recorded. But there are at least stories that the women continue to play. And by 1926, the press in Australia are reporting regularly on women's football matches. In July of 1926, the Queensland Ladies Soccer FA opens an official headquarters in downtown Brisbane. And newspapers now report regularly on the matches, including the fact that women now have proper uniforms and boots. The Queensland Ladies Soccer FA continues until at least 1927. In 1928, Sydney and Newcastle see teams like Currie North End, Weston, Abermain, Spears Point. A little west of Sydney in the 1930s, there are industry-based teams, the Zigzags, the State Mine, the Bluebirds, the Vale of Clwyd. In 1929, Spears Point beats Weston Ladies FC 1-0 for the New South Wales State Championship. And again in 1930, just west of Sydney, in Lithgow, two teams form the Women's Soccer FA to play against other teams in New South Wales. The Australians take a page from the English women's playbook and raise money for various charities. And soon, women are playing soccer all over the continent. From the 1930s through the 1970s, Australian women probably play continuously. From the 1930s to the 1970s, there's evidence that women never stopped playing, but the public seems to have not paid much attention. The press don't report very much on the matches after 1933. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come waltzing Matilda with me, and his ghost may be heard as you pass by that billabong. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. In the 1950s and 60s, Australian women seem to have just completely ignored FIFA, and the English ban on women playing. There are amateur leagues throughout Australia, as well as regional championships. In 1971, after 50 long years, the English FA and FIFA lift the ban on women playing soccer. In August 1974, Australian women hold their first national championship. This championship also brings together in one place most of the interested parties in women's football. During that tournament, in a cold tin roof shed in Sydney, the Australian Women's Soccer Association was founded. After years of teams and leagues working in isolation, there's now a national organization to coordinate women's football in Australia. And a national organization means a national team. And 5 years later, on Saturday, October 6, 1979, the team that would eventually be known as the Matildas played their first official international match against the Ferns, New Zealand's national team. Due to lack of funding, the Matildas' first 8 official matches were all played against the Ferns. Except, that's not quite true. In April of 1968, representatives of Hong Kong, Taiwan, Malaysia, and Singapore founded the Asian Ladies Football Confederation. Soon they are joined by Japan, Australia, and India. The ALFC is both a football organization and a very feminist organization. Among other things, they want a Women's World Cup. FIFA and the Asian Football Confederation, the men's organization, seem to have mostly ignored them. So, in 1975, the Asian Ladies Football Confederation announces and holds the first Asian Women's Championship in Hong Kong from August 25th through September 2nd. Thailand, Singapore, New Zealand, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and Australia all participate. Australia ends up in Group A with Thailand and Singapore. New Zealand's Ferns end up in Group B with Hong Kong and Malaysia. The group stage matches see attendances of more than 4,000 fans per match. All the group stage matches were played as doubleheaders in Hong Kong Stadium. For some reason, the matches they play are all just 60 minutes to 30-minute halves. On Sunday, August 31st, 1975, the Matildas will face New Zealand's Ferns in front of more than 6,500 fans, followed by a match between Thailand and Malaysia. New Zealand's Marilyn Marshall opens the scoring in the 17th minute, followed by Isabel Richardson in the 26th. It's 2-0 at the half, and Australia has work to do. Australia's Trixie Berry scores in the 51st minute, but Richardson answers almost immediately with another goal in the 52nd. It's now 3-1 New Zealand, with just minutes to go. Julie Dolan scores for Australia in the final minute, but it won't be enough. 2 days later, Australia will beat Malaysia 5-0 for third place in front of more than 11,500 fans. Later that day, New Zealand beat Thailand 3-1 to win the first Asian Women's Championship. The Asian Women's Championship is still being played today. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come waltzing Matilda with me. And his ghost may be heard as you pass by that billabong. You'll come waltzing Matilda. In 1976, the Asian Ladies Football Confederation again contacted FIFA about hosting a Women's World Cup. FIFA President Yao Havelange refused, saying only FIFA could organize a Women's World Cup, which they weren't going to do. The Republic of China Football Association, which is Taiwan, not mainland China, was happy to help the Asian Ladies Football Confederation. The men at FIFA grumbled and said, "Just don't call it a World Cup." And with that, the World Women's Football Invitational Tournament was born in 1978. 13 teams were invited from all over the world. The Asian Ladies and Republic of China Confederations would pay for all the costs of the team's travel and other expenses, so there was no reason for them to refuse. 3 national teams included Australia, Chinese Taipei, and Thailand. The other 10 teams were the best club teams from around the world who would temporarily don their country's kits to play. These teams were Hakas IF from Sweden, HJK Helsinki from Finland, Stade de Reims from France, Union SC Landhaus from Austria, SV Seebach from Switzerland, the Denmark 11, Canadian Roadrunners, and English 11, a team called Polynesia from Hawaii, and the Dallas Sting from the United States. The tournament was scheduled to start on October 9th in Taipei, but it was delayed until the 11th due to a typhoon and flooding. Over the next few days, teams played through their groups in huge puddles on the pitches in one of the first truly international women's tournaments. France and Finland eventually were awarded the joint championship. Australia placed 7th out of 13 teams. But the Matildas have now faced some of the strongest teams in the world. And they've done it on a budget that consists mostly of determination and Vegemite. Over the coming decades, the Matildas will see little in the way of pay or proper training facilities, doctors, or support from a wider community. Seemingly, through willpower, determination, and love of the game, they will first become a regional powerhouse, and then a serious contender for any international title. Thanks for listening, as always. If you like the show, please share it or leave a review. If you'd like to see some pictures of the teams and other things that we discuss on the show, check out the Slack channel. There's a link in the show notes. You can follow the show at ForgottenXI on Twitter. And I'd like to thank Fiona Crawford and Lee McGowan. Much of the information on this episode comes from their new book, Never Say Die, The 100-Year Overnight Success of Australian Women's Soccer. So go check that out. I'll see you next time.